Pentagon as the deputy to the Air Force Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, since that position was vacant. But then we got a second surprise. The Air Force was assigning me to be Chief of Intelligence for U.S. forces in South Korea. My first thought was an old saying I'd heard from my dad. There are four things in life you want to avoid. Pyorrhea, diarrhea, gonorrhea, and chorea. But I learned just how little influence Brigadier General Selects have over their destinies. I reported to Seoul in June 1985 and quickly discovered the obvious. Although the position in South Korea was designated for an Air Force officer, it was a job much better suited to an Army officer. It was a humbling experience as a new brigadier general to ask my team of Army colonels to mentor me on things like how to properly roll up the sleeves on my camouflage battle dress uniform. They also helped with Army slang and terminology used around the post, where initially I was almost as lost as I had been when I first reported to Tan Son Nhut Air Base as a lieutenant. I found that I was not just the senior intelligence officer for U.S. forces, but also the deputy to a Korean Air Force two-star in the U.S.-South Korea Combined Forces Command, someone who knew very little about intelligence and was looking to me for guidance. Fortunately, both of the Republic of Korea are okay. Generals whom I served as deputy were capable, smart, and easy to work with, and we eventually found our way. My big boss, Commander of U.S. Forces Korea, Army Four-Star General Bill Livesey, had been a lieutenant platoon leader with the 3rd Infantry Division during the Korean War and dug in on the front line when the armistice took effect on July 27, 1953. He knew his business and suffered no fools. He was salty and, in the tradition of General George Patton, excelled at colorful profanity when the occasion called for it. On day one, he made it very clear that the Korean War had never formally ended. The 1953 armistice was just a ceasefire agreement, and North Korea could and would invade the South if given the opportunity. From that premise, he gave me his very clear expectations for intelligence. He demanded 48 hours of warning ahead of a North Korean attack to give him time to activate the operations plan for the defense of the peninsula and to evacuate all U.S. dependents in South Korea. And because taking those irrevocable actions would have huge diplomatic consequences for the United States and major political implications for the ROK, Livesey required a 48-hour unambiguous warning. We had to know for certain that an attack was imminent and not a bluff or a feint. General Livesey was not one for subtle nuance. Andy enrolled at the Seoul American High School, whose wonderful principal, Sue Jackson, delivered a classic line at our first parents' town hall. "I'll make a deal with all of you. We'll take with a grain of salt any stories we hear about what happens at home, if you take with a grain of salt any stories you hear about what happens at school." We found the South Koreans generously warm and hospitable, somehow discovering our preferences and catering to them without our asking, and on our birthdays sending enough flowers to make our house look and smell like a funeral home. As an 8th grader, Andy took the subway in Seoul alone, without our ever worrying. And we've always joked that Sue earned her black belt in shopping in Seoul's famous Itaewon shopping area, not far from the Yongsan Army Garrison where we were stationed in Seoul. As Sue and Andy got settled, and as Jennifer was starting college in Virginia, I began to try to understand the operational situation. I read all the intelligence reports I could get my hands on and memorized the North Korean order of battle. While I had mastered the details, I was having trouble seeing the larger picture. One day I was talking with one of my senior civilian intelligence analysts and asked for his advice on how to gain a broader, more strategic perspective. He suggested I visit the post library at Yongsan to read the official U.S. Army history of the Korean War. I ended up spending several Saturdays there, immersing myself in the archives. At the Pentagon, I'd often heard the military truism that Every nation is preparing to refight its last war. Militaries are led by bureaucracies that want to prove they've learned from their past mistakes, and they'll apply those lessons to whatever situation they encounter next. The North Korea of 1985, much like the North Korea of 2018, was stuck in the paradigm of warfare in 1953. From reading the official history, I gathered that's why leaders of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea amassed their forces and supplies along the north edge of the DMZ, so they wouldn't be reliant on a lengthy mobilization and extended lines of communication. Also because they remembered the impact of U.S. carrier aviation during the war, they maintained two separate attack submarine fleets, one on each coast. Importantly, I read about the North Koreans activating two core-level command and control entities not long before they crossed the 38th parallel on June 25, 1950, to manage their invading divisions. And so I considered that an important indication of a potential invasion. Correlating the history I'd learned in the library with the daily intelligence reports, with help from a couple of my senior Army colonel mentors, I developed a briefing to explain the local situation to distinguished visitors, and I tested it on General Livesey. He liked the presentation, and even more, my starched battle dress uniform with glistening paratrooper boots and properly rolled sleeves. I think he had decided to consider his Air Force One Star as a reclamation project, so he took a personal interest in me. He enjoyed trotting me out and proudly pointing out to his Army general contemporaries his Air Force intelligence officer, who looked and talked so very Army. Still, on at least one occasion, I proved to be pretty clueless. Among my responsibilities as the senior intelligence officer was oversight of what was called the 8th Army Tunnel Neutralization Team, or TNT, a small contingent of U.S. Army soldiers attached to an ROK Army Engineer Battalion. This joint unit was tasked with searching for DPRK tunnels under the demilitarized zone, which we assessed they planned to use to sneak special operations forces into the south in the first stages of an invasion. Over a period of years, three such tunnels had been found, one of which had become both a major tourist attraction and a required visit for all military-age males in the ROK. Finding a fourth tunnel would have had huge domestic political impact, and so was a high priority for the ROK government. The major role of the Tunnel Neutralization Team was to provide intelligence to the ROK Army Engineer Battalion, which used several water well rigs to drill wherever we assessed a tunnel might be. The battalion searched whenever we got reports of underground compressor or drilling sounds, or when shreds of burlap, which were used to line the tunnels, turned up in nearby rice paddies. We tried to apply seismic detectors as well, but the geology near the DMZ was very noisy. I once inquired how many holes had been dug and was told 3,400, more than 13 holes per kilometer along the 254-kilometer length of the DMZ. I suggested that if we tore off the peninsula along the resulting perforated line, it would eliminate the tunnel threat. My ROK friends didn't find the remark amusing. One day in early December 1985, the commander of the U.S. TNT detachment, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Cradiville, a career military intelligence officer with a master's degree in geology, came to my office to tell me, rather animatedly, that his team had located a hot prospect for the fourth tunnel. He asked me to visit the drill site, both to see what his team and the ROK Army engineers had discovered, and to flash my new Brigadier General Star to motivate the U.S. and ROK troops. On December 17, 1985, a date I'll never forget, we boarded a UH-1 Huey helicopter for the short ride from the Yongsan military garrison in Seoul up to the DMZ and the drill site. The Huey was fully loaded with two Army pilots, Command Sergeant Major Ray Oath, Colonel Del Morris, Deputy U.S. Forces Korea Command Engineer Lieutenant Colonel Mike Rodriguez, Gary, and me. I had earphones and could listen to the pilots conversing, but did not have a map. Gary had a map, but couldn't hear the cockpit. As we learned, this was a less than optimal arrangement. It was a 30-minute ride to the drill site in the Chorwan Valley, the nominal center of the peninsula and one of the two major invasion corridors when the North Koreans streamed south in June 1950. As we approached the site, the pilots were unable to establish radio contact with the soldiers on the ground. It was a clear day, and we were flying under visual flight rules rather than using instruments and navigation aids. Even so, pilots were required to have both radio and visual contact when flying or landing near the narrow DMZ. The co-pilot, Chief Warrant Officer 2 Concetta Hassan, who had led a Horatio Alger-type life and had already been the subject of a made-for-TV movie a few months earlier, was on just her second flight mission since arriving in the ROK. Through my headset, I heard her suggest that we fly higher to gain radio comms. The other pilot agreed and ascended 300 feet. Sure enough, we heard our contacts at the landing site. Unfortunately, during the maneuver, the pilot lost sight of the pond that served as the major landmark in the area and inadvertently lined up on another pond, just north of the DMZ. I began to hear a sound like popcorn in a microwave and looked out the side of the aircraft to see white puffs below us. At about the same time, I heard a very loud, persistent, and annoying automated broadcast coming through my earphones. "Red Dog Fox! Red Dog Fox!" repeated over and over, which meant someone had crossed the DMZ. That someone was us. Up front, CW2 Hassan took the controls, dove, turned, and after some evasive maneuvering, an unnatural act for a Huey with a full load, wheeled us around and got us back to South Korean airspace. Her maneuvers used a lot of fuel, and because we'd already traveled a long distance, we landed at a field-deployed rubber fuel bladder, gassed up with the rotor blades still turning, and then returned home to Yongsan. We didn't find out until the helicopter was back in its hangar that a round had penetrated its main rotor. Miraculously, the rotor stayed intact on the leg back to Yongsan, even with the weight of the additional fuel and a full passenger load. From the helicopter pad, my driver was waiting to take me back to my office, and I matter-of-factly told Gary that we'd need to reschedule the trip since we never made it to the drill site. Still shaken, he gave me a quizzical look. When I walked into my office, the red phone, a direct emergency line to the around-the-clock command post, was ringing. I had been in Korea about 6 months, and that was the first time it had ever rung. On the other end was a duty officer who told me, "My God, sir, we thought you were a goner." After I assured him we were fine, another phone rang, a direct hotline from General Livesey. I braced myself and answered, and what followed made General Fouts's Sunday morning phone call in Virginia seem like a pep talk. At high volume, General Livesey instructed me on an important distinction between practices of the Air Force and the Army. In the Air Force, the senior pilot is designated as aircraft commander, the official in charge of the safety of the aircraft, regardless of the rank of any passengers. That was not the case in the Army. So thereafter, whenever I flew as the senior-ranking officer in an Army helicopter, I made sure I always had a map and headphones and knew where I was. To General Livesey's relief, the incident didn't get much media play outside of Korea. The United Nations Command conducted a standard investigation and conveniently determined that we'd only made a shallow penetration of the DMZ. A few days later, a nervous ROK Army regimental commander showed up at my office to apologize. The incident investigation determined that the round that hit the rotor was from an M60 machine gun, a weapon the DPRK didn't have. The commander explained that the rules of engagement called for ROK Army elements along the DMZ to assume that any aircraft flying north was defecting and to shoot them out of the sky. We'd been taking fire from both the north and south, and it turned out the ROK soldiers were better shots. I went home that night and hugged Sue and Andy. I continued to study and to work at absorbing Army culture. I became more adept at reading General Livesey and grew to admire the way in which, with his Georgia accent, he conveniently played dumb Southern boy, though I knew he'd graduated first in his class from the Army's Command and General Staff College. When Secretary of the Army John O. Marsh visited, and I gave him my well-honed briefing on North Korea, Marsh asked how I felt about serving as an Air Force officer in what was essentially an Army position. I told him I appreciated the institutional commitment the Army had made to intelligence, and that I'd learned a lot about the intelligence profession by seeing it from the viewpoint of another service. I didn't know it yet, but assigning mid-grade and senior officers to joint duty tours across services would be one of the major features of the Goldwater-Nichols Act in October 1986, an effort in which Marsh was heavily involved. As the senior intelligence officer in Korea, I eventually grew confident enough in my understanding of the situation that I could honestly admit to General Livesey that we could not meet the expectation he'd demanded of me on day one. I'd become convinced there was simply no way to provide him with unambiguous warning that North Korea was going to attack. I told him the only unambiguous sign he would have is when North Korean artillery shells started falling on Seoul. He didn't like my answer, but he accepted it. I also came to believe the whole idea of having warning before North Korea executed a planned invasion was moot, as the much more likely circumstance leading to a conflict would be some small incident spiraling out of control, something like the events that had preceded Operation Paul Bunyan in 1976. 30 years passed between when I reached that conclusion and my diplomatic visit to North Korea as DNI in November 2014. As control of the regime passed from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, my personal assessment of the threat posed by the Hermit Kingdom never changed. If anything, the actions and the public pronouncements of the dear leaders over the decades reinforced my conclusion that none of them wanted to go back to fighting, but that they've kept the mechanics of war set on a hair trigger, and that any sane U.S. policy on North Korea needed to be based on an understanding of that dynamic. There is an unwritten, almost sacred writ of the intelligence profession that we in intelligence should avoid engaging in policy formation or execution. We support policy makers by providing them timely, accurate, relevant, even anticipatory intelligence, but we don't participate in making the policy sausage. Our objective, typically, is to reduce uncertainty for decision makers as much as possible, whether they're in the Oval Office, at the negotiating table, or on the battlefield. As DNI, I was careful not to advocate for specific policies in National Security Council meetings. However, Korea was one issue on which I let President Obama know, privately, that I thought his policy rationale of not discussing anything else until North Korea agreed to end its nuclear capability and ambitions was flawed. And after my 2014 mission to North Korea, I discussed my observations and views with analysts and policymakers in the national security field. I had not fully appreciated the consuming siege mentality that pervades North Korea until I visited and engaged directly with senior officials there. The leadership elites in the North work hard to maximize paranoia among the population. Portraying the United States as an enemy that's constantly on the brink of invading it is one of the chief propaganda themes that's held North Korea together for the past 60 years. They are also deadly serious about any perceived affronts to the supreme leader, whom they literally consider a deity. The DPRK is a family-owned country and has been that way ever since it was founded in the 1940s. Because of its history, The DPRK sees developing nuclear weapons as its insurance policy and ticket to survival. North Korea wants to be recognized as a world power, and its entire society, including their conventional military forces, suffers for the relentless, single-minded commitment to develop and field these weapons and delivery systems to threaten the United States. Neither they nor we really know if their weapons work, but in many ways it doesn't matter. They achieved nuclear deterrence long ago, because we have to assume that if they do launch an ICBM at the United States, it will reach our shores and detonate. They have effectively played their nuclear hand to the hilt, for without even proving they have the relevant capability, they've capitalized on nuclear deterrence. I believe and have advocated that to counter North Korea, the United States needs to consider capitalizing on our greatest strengths, openness, and information. The DPRK survives because it fosters isolation. Outside the ruling clique, there is great interest in the outside world. Currently, we have limited means to satisfy their citizens' hunger for information, something very difficult to do in the absence of a physical presence in the country. If we set aside for a minute our demand that they disarm before we'll talk, we could establish a presence in Pyongyang in the form of a U.S. interests section, modeled on the one we maintained in Havana for decades to deal with the Cuban government we didn't recognize. We would not need to present this as reward for bad behavior, but rather as an opportunity for direct physical access, which would enhance our insight and understanding and, perhaps even more importantly, foster interaction with the people of the DPRK and enable the flow of information from the rest of the world. We would, of course, reciprocate by allowing them to establish a similar mission in Washington. I don't think this would represent a huge leap over their existing presence in the United States at the United Nations in New York. I'm not naive about the existence of formidable antibodies to what I'm suggesting in the U.S. government, but I don't see any other way to resolve the impasse. The DPRK won't budge because they see us as an existential threat. If we are going to get out of the static adversarial holding pattern we're in now, we have to be the bigger partner and make the breakthrough, to use the preferred term the North Koreans used with me. At this writing, the situation in North Korea seems poised for change, whether for better or for worse remains to be seen. Events and pronouncements in the first year of President Trump's administration, including increasingly successful DPRK ballistic missile tests and an apparently successful thermonuclear test, heightened tensions between our two countries. Taunts between Trump and Kim Jong-un only served to shorten the fuses of the military forces on both sides, as the DPRK army stands ready to rain fire down on the 10 million residents of Seoul at a moment's notice. Then, in March 2018, a South Korean envoy in Washington informed President Trump that Supreme Leader Kim was willing to discuss giving up North Korea's nuclear program. Surprising everyone, Trump accepted the invitation to talk. What I would hope, but doubt will happen, is that the United States will enter talks with a long-game strategy in mind. America has had a substantial military presence on the peninsula for almost 68 years. If we can figure out a way, over time, with sequenced, mutually verified steps, to lead the DPRK government to where they don't feel so threatened, we could move away from the rhetorical cusp of a cataclysmic war. If we can offer a roadmap to the U.S. military's withdrawing much of its forces from the peninsula, while the North Koreans reduce the large conventional forces they have along the DMZ, including the huge artillery and rocketry forces that are dug in, ready to fire on Seoul, that would de-escalate the situation and lessen the danger of a minor incident quickly escalating to nuclear war. In the late 1990s, when I was out of the government, I participated in the so-called Track 2 dialogue with members of the North Korean UN mission in New York. Over a dinner, one of the North Koreans spoke about transforming the United Nations command into a peacekeeping force to serve as a buffer between the North and the South. So even they have considered a different arrangement on the peninsula. A reasonable first step might be to meet their demands for a peace treaty, as all we have now is a ceasefire, which began when the warring sides simply stopped shooting. In their minds, the war could resume immediately. We remain stuck on our narrative, and they are, or perhaps merely have been until recently, stuck on theirs. Only the bigger partner can change those narratives. I hope we can think ambitiously and be willing to go long, and perhaps this is our opportunity to do so. Unfortunately, I don't think we're postured either philosophically or bureaucratically to achieve that. In July 1986, I was finally sure I'd earned General Livesey's trust when he asked me to accompany him on a field trip with only his wife, Bina, and his aide-de-camp. We rode a Huey to the eastern side of the peninsula, and then a truck from the landing zone into the mountains. When the truck could go no further, we walked. Finally, wearing battle-rattle armor, helmets, heavy Kevlar vests, canteens, and other items that all clanked as we moved, we climbed three wooden ladders to reach a mountaintop. There we found the battle position Livesey's platoon had held when the ceasefire went into effect 33 years earlier. He walked around and began to describe that final day of combat in a way that reminded me of the scene in the movie Patton, where George C. Scott, playing George Patton, recounted the Battle of Carthage. Livesey looked down at the terrain and pointed to where the waves of Chinese troops had come at his platoon. He described how they'd concentrated fire to repel the attacks. He recalled the sounds and smells as they held their ground and called in airstrikes. Just before the ceasefire took effect at 10 p.m. on July 27th, both sides had opened up a massive artillery barrage, lighting up the night and making the mountainside shake. As he relived the experience and shared it with us, I felt as though I was in the presence of a demigod, returned from Hades, to recount an experience that could never really be understood by mortal man. Sometime later, Livesey summoned me to his office to ask for my thoughts on whom he should pick to become the next commanding general of the 2nd Infantry Division. He gave me three names and explained that he wanted my judgment, which he felt would be neutral and unpolluted by army politics. I offered my thoughts, which he ultimately agreed with. A few months later, when Livesey was asked to stay for a third year as commander of U.S. Forces Korea until he retired, I asked him if I could also remain. The tour in Korea, which I'd been so skeptical of, had turned out to be one of the most rewarding assignments for both me and my family. Livesey said he appreciated the offer, but for the sake of my career, it was time for me to move on. In July 1987, Sue, Andy, and I moved back to Hawaii, where I was assigned to U.S. Pacific Command as what amounted to the senior intelligence officer for all U.S. forces across the surface of more than half the globe. In Hawaii, I quickly realized just how much the world had changed in the 2 years I'd been so heavily focused on the Korean Peninsula. In 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev had come to power as the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, giving a speech that May in which he talked about major reforms that sounded shockingly democratic and capitalist. In 1986, he introduced the Russian words glasnost, openness, and perestroika, restructuring, to the Western vocabulary. The Soviet Union had been our primary adversary, our archenemy, through most of my life, and now there was open talk of our relationship changing. I also found that the Goldwater-Nichols Act had profoundly changed the relationship between combatant commanders and the military services. U.S. PACOM Commander Admiral Ron Hayes, and then in 1988 Admiral Hunt Hardesty, reported directly to the Secretary of Defense, enjoying more official access and autonomy than Admiral Geiler had. As their senior intelligence officer, I liked and respected both men, but never had as close a relationship with either as I felt I had had with General Livesey. Sue and I also found that Oahu had changed a lot since we'd left in 1978. High-rise hotels had sprung up all over Waikiki, and the island was choked with traffic and tourists. Because Hawaii was more of a magnet for visitors than Korea, I found that a great deal of my time was taken up with distinguished visitors, either foreign dignitaries who'd come to the island on their way to the mainland, or U.S. officials whose planes were stopping at Hickam Air Force Base, adjacent to the Pearl Harbor Naval Base, to refuel. I spent countless hours in the small auditorium that we fondly called the Blue Bedroom, where polished young briefers presented the Pacific Area Update, a scripted briefing that they had memorized. One of the many command performances was delivered to the King of Tonga, a remarkably massive man of at least 300 pounds. Mid-briefing, the king fell asleep and began snoring loudly. Admiral Hayes gestured to the briefers to keep going. The rest of us remained quiet so as not to disturb the king's slumber. Perhaps the most bizarre VIP visit was from Vice President Dan Quayle. His plane was stopping at Hickam in the middle of the night, and en route, the VP said he wanted to play a pickup basketball game while it refueled, he and his security detail against a PACOM team. At 3 a.m. We scrambled to find 5 players, and the only reason it was competitive was that our side had Colonel Jack Graham, who'd played varsity basketball for the Air Force Academy a few decades earlier. We ensured the vice president's team won, but only by a little. In 1988, I was promoted to Major General. My heart's desire was to take command of the Air Force Electronic Security Command. Not only would that make for a poetic bookend for my career, taking me back to the command where I started as a young lieutenant in 1963, but it would be an especially meaningful assignment, putting me in charge of a large portion of Air Force intelligence assets and focusing them on tracking the great changes taking place in the Soviet Union, just as cracks were appearing in the Iron Curtain. But that was not to be. Instead, I received orders to report to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska to be the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence for Strategic Air Command. Sue and I were preparing for the move when the already tense situation in China flared up. On April 15, 1989, we monitored from U.S. Pacific Command as students from several Beijing universities spontaneously gathered in Tiananmen Square, the massive 100-acre public space just outside the Forbidden City. Demonstrations against the government grew, and several thousand students demanded the party recognize them. As the somewhat sympathetic General Secretary, Zhao Ziyang, left on a scheduled trip to North Korea, the militaristic Premier Li Peng denounced their actions as an anti-government revolt, promising to crack down. On the following day, close to 100,000 students responded with a massive protest in the square. In crisis mode, we reported any updates from our military attachés in Beijing to PACOM leaders and to Washington. The situation worsened as the students keyed protests to a scheduled visit from Mikhail Gorbachev. 3 days before his visit, 300,000 people staged a hunger strike and refused to leave the square, forcing the Chinese Communist Party to formally welcome Gorbachev at the airport. It was a huge embarrassment, and worse, coverage by Chinese media led to sympathy for the students across the nation. The government declared martial law and mobilized the People's Liberation Army. All of our military attachés were put on lockdown, which profoundly cut into the quality of our intelligence picture. We still had satellite imagery, snapshots of vehicle movements, but didn't really know what units had mobilized, what they were doing, and what was happening in the streets. Outside some creative tradecraft on the ground that provided some insight into PLA activities, we were nearly blind, and unfortunately there wasn't much we could do for the student protesters. We watched, helpless, as the PLA rolled tanks and soldiers toward the square on the night of June 3rd. The protesters tried to block their entrance, but troops opened fire, killing protesters in rolling skirmishes. In the dark early morning hours, the students and PLA troops had a final violent clash. We still don't know for certain how many students and protesters died, but a very recently declassified British intelligence cable puts the number killed at more than 10,000 and details both the brutality of the slaughter and the desecration of human remains that followed. In U.S. Pacific Command, we were shocked, outraged, and heartbroken. And for many of us, it was also a stark lesson on the limits of intelligence. Within weeks, I had to put those somber events in China behind me and once again focus on another challenge. Just as Pacific Command forced me to open my aperture beyond the Korean Peninsula, moving to Strategic Air Command compelled a look beyond the Pacific region, as large as it was, to take in the entire globe. In 1989, SAC had responsibility for all U.S. strategic reconnaissance aircraft, the U-2 and SR-71 spy planes, and the more prominent U.S. arsenal of ICBMs and all the U.S. strategic bombers, the B-1 Lancer and the B-52 Stratofortress bombers, which the North Koreans so feared. As Sue and I were unpacking in July 1989, the B-2 Spirit stealth bomber was making its first test flight. Trying to hold on to my favorite part of living in Hawaii, I'd paid to ship my beloved yellow MG convertible to the mainland, but July in Nebraska was entirely too hot and humid to drive the car, which lacked air conditioning. I stowed it for the summer and had a couple of months of joy in the fall until, in the first of the hard freezes Nebraska was famous for, it went into a deep coma and never recovered. As I worked to understand and master my new responsibilities, Sue and Andy settled into their own routines. Andy enrolled for his senior year in his third high school in nearby Bellevue. Only later would we realize that he emerged from all the moves a better person. Jenny and Andy are both wonderful, and I'm incredibly proud of how well Sue raised them. I only served at SAC for 8 months, but it was a time of turmoil. In part inspired by the protests in Tiananmen Square, the Warsaw Pact countries began to shed Soviet control and free themselves of their communist governments. During the short time I was at Offutt, we saw revolutionary elections in Poland, Hungary, East Germany, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. On November 9th, a confused member of the Socialist Unity Party in East Germany mistakenly announced at a press conference that guards along the Berlin Wall would begin allowing people to pass from East Berlin into West Berlin, effective immediately. That wasn't true. But as crowds rushed the gates, the overwhelmed guards let them through. That night I watched the television coverage as people chiseled away at the wall and celebrated in the streets. The cold warrior in me was amazed and delighted. The intelligence officer in me was concerned. So much instability surrounding the Soviets' massive military forces, particularly their nuclear arsenal, was inherently dangerous. At Strategic Air Command, we focused on understanding what was happening to the vestiges of Soviet military power. By the time I left in March, things in the former Soviet bloc were tumultuous. While at SAC, I flew 37 missions in the Looking Glass Airborne Command Post that's featured in the film Dr. Strangelove. From any of the dozen or so Boeing 707 aircraft at Offutt, each specially reconfigured and redesignated as an Air Force EC-135, the command staff could maintain communications with vital elements of U.S. strategic forces and could convey orders to the ICBM silos, strategic bombers, and ballistic missile submarines. The Air Force had a requirement that an EC-135 be airborne with a general officer aboard at all times, with no lapses, ever, which translated to 3 missions of 8-plus hours a day. Remarkably, Looking Glass aircraft were airborne and mission-ready continuously for 31 years. As a 2-star general, I found myself doing shift work again, taking my turns in the rotation of all the 1- and 2-star generals assigned throughout SAC. While airborne, we ran exercises to assess our readiness to respond if threatened. We could always respond with catastrophic force. We could never prevent the annihilation of our homeland. No one who'd held the responsibility for deploying nuclear weapons during an exercise could deny that reality. It was this experience that convinced me that neither side would ever intentionally inflict a nuclear attack on the other. Thankfully, the most exciting thing that ever happened on those flights was when an occasional Boy Scout troop or Chamber of Commerce group visited the underground SAC command post for a tour. They would call up Looking Glass, and I would answer as the disembodied voice in the sky, giving them a short, scripted briefing and reassurances they were well protected. The orientation flight I took in January 1990 in a 2-seat U-2 spy plane was a much more exciting experience. Over 68,000 feet up, at the edge of space, I could see all of Northern California. The sky was purple, fading to black above me. All the world's problems, North Korea's aggression, China's oppression of its own citizens, the uncertainty of what was happening to all those Soviet weapons, seemed small and far away. For 4 short hours, the pilot and I were above all other concerns. Fun doesn't fully capture the experience. It was transcendent, although I did wonder what I would do if the pilot had a heart attack. That March, the highly esteemed Air Force Chief of Staff, General Larry Welch, summoned me back to the Pentagon, where fun goes to die. I left almost immediately, while the commander of SAC, General Jack Chain, graciously allowed Sue and Andy to stay in our quarters at Offutt so that Andy could graduate. Back in Washington, I joined the Air Force staff as its senior intelligence officer. I briefly lived with Jen and her husband Jay in their townhouse until Sue had joined me in government quarters at Bolling Air Force Base in July. While my 2 most recent career moves had opened my view of the world, my focus from the Pentagon narrowed to a tiny nation in the Middle East, Kuwait, and to the airspace above its neighbor, Iraq. Throughout the 1980s, the United States had grudgingly backed Iraq in its war with Iran, preferring almost anyone to Iran after the 1979 revolution. Invading Iran in 1980 had been a terrible miscalculation by the new Iraqi president, Saddam Hussein, and support from the United States and Saudi Arabia was really the only reason Iran had not reversed the invasion and conquered Iraq. In the 2 years since the Iran-Iraq War had ended in 1988, Hussein had ruled as a brutal dictator, using executions as a management tool, and even inflicting mustard gas and nerve agents on his own people in the ethnically Kurdish north. He had aggressively rebuilt his army after the war and boasted that he had 1 million soldiers, although U.S. intelligence estimated the number as closer to 600,000. When I returned to the Pentagon in March 1990, the only person in the U.S. government who really thought Iraq would invade Kuwait was Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. Of course, he also thought Gorbachev was about to be overthrown and the Soviet Union was going to come roaring back. General Welch retired and was succeeded by General Mike Dugan, who only lasted 6 weeks before Secretary Cheney fired him. A move I believe was more about Cheney's asserting civilian control over the military than about Dugan's allegedly overstepping his bounds with the media. Meanwhile, Saddam had massed his troops at the Kuwait border, including his elite Republican Guard. A nervous consensus evolved that Saddam was bluffing. At that point, we were still sharing intelligence with Iraq and selling them arms. On July 31st, General Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander of U.S. Central Command and, under Goldwater Nichols, the general responsible for running any military operations in and around Iraq, briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including General Colin Powell, in the tank, the JCS's secure briefing room in the Pentagon. He said that there were a lot of reasons for Saddam Hussein to bluff, most of them having to do with money Hussein owed Kuwait or his desire to manipulate oil prices. He concluded that the chances of Iraq invading Kuwait were slim. Obviously, U.S. intelligence hadn't served General Schwarzkopf well in the weeks leading up to that meeting. We had an exquisite overhead capability to take digital pictures from space and beam them directly to the agencies in and around the Washington area. We had analysts who could count the precise number of tanks and artillery pieces in each formation, and we knew the Iraqi order of battle and its capabilities cold. We were just not as good at determining what Hussein intended to do with them. Schwarzkopf later said he hated the intelligence words of estimative uncertainty, and that we almost never told him something was certain or almost certain. He heard a lot of probably, probably not, and chances about even, which he found particularly unhelpful. He also found it dysfunctional and less than helpful that the major intelligence agencies and the service intelligence components were all telling him different things, and no one was figuring out why they all seemed to disagree. In 2014, when I was DNI and Russia had troops massed on the border of eastern Ukraine, I remembered General Schwarzkopf's complaints. We didn't have any better insight into what was going on in Putin's head in 2014 than we did in Hussein's in 1990. But with the advent of social media and our expanded use of satellite imagery provided by commercial companies, we had progressed in seeing indications and providing warning of impending action. In the end, though, having such insight didn't stop Putin from annexing Crimea in March 2014. On August 2, 1990, 2 days after Schwarzkopf's Pentagon briefing, Iraq invaded and then overran Kuwait. In less than 2 days, Saddam gained control and declared Kuwait the 19th province of Iraq. He parked his tank formations and his massive army along the Kuwaiti border with Saudi Arabia, pointed at the Saudi capital of Riyadh, less than 300 miles away, about the driving distance from New Haven, Connecticut to Washington, D.C., with nothing but open desert in the way. On August 3rd, General Schwarzkopf asked Lieutenant General Chuck Horner, the commander of the 9th Air Force and the Combined Forces Air Component Commander for U.S. Central Command, to design the coming air campaign and to work as the forward-deployed commander of CENTCOM forces. He then dispatched Horner to Riyadh to receive U.S. troops and equipment as they arrived in Saudi Arabia. My primary job in all this was to support the Air Force Chief of Staff as he managed the provision of Air Force resources to Schwarzkopf and Horner so that they could defeat the Iraqis when President Bush gave the order in January 1991. Unfortunately, not everyone in the Pentagon saw it that way. 4 years later, in 1995, the Air University published a breathless account of Colonel John A. Warden III, the Air Force Deputy Director for Warfighting Concepts, and his checkmate think tank in the basement of the Pentagon at the time. It described how Colonel Warden flew to Riyadh to present General Horner with the Air Force's plan to win the war solely by using air power, a phrase always capitalized, without need of any other military services. Horner unceremoniously dispatched Warden back to Washington, but kept some of his staff who'd made the trip, including Lieutenant Colonel Dave Deptula, who ended up doing a lot of the real planning for Desert Storm when U.S. and coalition forces routed the Iraqis the following January. I got to know and respect Dave as he advanced through the ranks, ultimately to Lieutenant General, and I often sought his opinion when intelligence and Air Force operations crossed paths. On August 9th, before Colonel Warden's ill-fated attempt to lecture General Horner in Riyadh, Warden's boss, Major General Minter Alexander, called and asked me to break off some of my intelligence staff, who were quite busy trying to keep the Air Force leadership current on the daily situation, and send them down to Warden in checkmate to help him pick targets in Iraq. I'd been in contact with General Horner's intelligence chief, and I knew Horner had no idea that the Pentagon staff were designing an air campaign. I don't remember the specific words I used on the phone with Minter, but having had the experience of serving in Korea, at Pacific Command, and at Strategic Air Command, as well as having the ability to imagine how General Livesey would have reacted if a staff officer from the Pentagon basement showed up in Seoul to give him a battle plan for defeating North Korea without having to worry about ground forces, I told Minter in my politest two-star general peer-to-peer phrasing that I believed General Horner was in charge of the air war and that, regardless, my staff wasn't configured to comply with his request. Minter then appealed to Air Force Vice Chief of Staff, four-star General Mike Lowe, who tried to force my hand. I believed they were way out of their lane and were not helping the efforts of Schwarzkopf and Horner, who actually had to fight the war. So I didn't budge. General Lowe, along with all the air power advocates, labeled me as recalcitrant, someone who just didn't get it. The Air University account goes much further in excoriating me as an air power non-believer. My telephone conversation with Minter Alexander is scripted over 3 pages of direct quotes, which I informed the Air University commander were all fabricated, but he printed them anyway. Shortly after the book came out, I received a classy note of apology from Minter Alexander. Obviously, this matter still sticks in my craw. But I'm writing about all of this because so much of the doctrinal infighting impacted me years down the road. The book correctly points out that Colonel Worden in the Pentagon had much better imagery intelligence than General Horner did in Riyadh. We had these great digital pictures in Washington, but to get them to the American forces in and around Kuwait, we had to print them out and fly them to the war zone on a courier plane, literally halfway around the world. We still had the same problem we'd faced in Vietnam, intelligence arriving too late to be useful. It was a great frustration at the time. Also, in many ways, the Air Force's resistance to the reforms dictated by the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986 foreshadowed the opposition some intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA, would have for the measures dictated by the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, which created the Director of National Intelligence. There are obvious differences between those two landmark laws, but both ask the individual elements, military branches or intelligence agencies, to subordinate their primacy to the larger enterprise. 4 years after Goldwater-Nichols, powerful figures within the Air Force still resisted its role as force provider to the combatant commanders, and were fighting a rearguard bureaucratic insurgency. Similarly, when I became DNI 5.5 years after legislation to reform the IC was enacted, some influential voices within the intelligence agencies were still exhibiting passive-aggressive opposition to the notion that their component missions were part of the larger intelligence enterprise. On October 30, 1990, General Tony McPeak became Air Force Chief of Staff. McPeak supported Goldwater-Nichols and General Schwarzkopf's authority through General Horner to execute operations in the Central Command Area of Authority, which effectively ended the fight over the air power plan. But he also was a dyed-in-the-wool fighter pilot who had a reputation for disdain for the intelligence profession and those who engaged in it, a conviction shaped by his combat experience in Vietnam, when he believed intelligence professionals had held back information that pilots needed to safely and effectively conduct their missions. As the senior intelligence officer of the Air Force staff, I was in McPeak's direct line of sight and potentially line of fire. I told Sue that we'd had a pretty good run and that achieving the rank of Major General was a respectable accomplishment. On January 17, 1991, with doctrinal disputes behind us, General Schwarzkopf's forces switched from Desert Shield to Desert Storm and went on the offensive. For the next 5 weeks, Air Force and Navy jets bombarded the Iraqi forces, quickly destroying their air and anti-air capabilities, and then command and control. Under General Horner's direction, coalition forces flew unopposed bomb runs on Iraqi army positions. The only seemingly difficult task in the air war was trying to find the camouflaged mobile Scud missile launchers in the desert before they could fire toward Israel or Saudi Arabia. Still, everyone braced for a brutal ground confrontation with the massive numbers of supposedly elite Iraqi troops in Kuwait and along the border of Saudi Arabia. We particularly were concerned that the Iraqis would use their stockpiles of chemical weapons on the invading coalition troops. On February 24th, after feinting a Marine Corps amphibious assault into Kuwait City from the Persian Gulf, coalition forces swept into Kuwait and Iraq from Saudi Arabia. U.S. Army M1A1 tanks and Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt close-air support jets dominated Iraqi armor. Iraqi forces put up almost no resistance, either laying down their arms and surrendering, or running before the fight reached them. Schwarzkopf said he could have driven straight to Baghdad if he had been ordered to. But we stopped after liberating Kuwait, ending the ground assault just 100 hours after it started. In the months following the war, General Schwarzkopf gave high praise to almost everyone involved in almost every aspect of the operation. The one exception was intelligence. We had counted the Iraqi order of battle down to a level of detail that was probably unnecessary. What we failed to do was to give any insight into the Iraqi soldiers' will to fight. In that respect, we'd vastly overrated the Iraqi army, something we'd do again in 2014, when cities in Iraq were depending on it to defend them from the Islamic State. Schwarzkopf had 2 complaints. First, as combatant commander, he had control of all the mainline traditional military forces in the theater from each of the services, but he had no idea what special operations forces or the CIA elements were doing. Bob Gates, who became director of Central Intelligence and of the CIA in November 1991, took that complaint seriously and set out to address the matter. Schwarzkopf's second complaint centered on his disappointment with the imagery intelligence he'd received. He argued widely, loudly, and correctly that he'd had no wide-area imagery to see the total expanse of his battle space. We'd provided him postage-stamp photos, tiny pictures without any context of how they fit into the overall theater of war, which was like looking at a patch of land through a soda straw. Worse, we'd provided these images far too slowly to be useful. And to his frustration, there was no single agency he could contact to coordinate imagery collection and analysis and get results to him quickly. Given General McPeak's antipathy toward intelligence officers and my conflict with senior generals in the Pentagon over who should design and control the air war over Iraq, I figured my time in uniform would soon be over. So, once again, Sue and I started making retirement plans. But my military career had one more assignment in store. Chapter 3. The Peace Dividend. In 1991, the U.S. intelligence community included 4 large full-time intelligence agencies and the 4 intelligence components of the military services. The Department of Defense harbored 3 of the major intelligence agencies, the National Security Agency, NSA, the lead for intercepting signals and communications, established when I was in grade school in 1952, and that my dad, Sue's dad, Sue and I had served in, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, the central hub for intelligence on foreign military capabilities and intentions, and the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, the organization that designed, launched, and flew intelligence satellites, including all the overhead missions to keep tabs on the Soviets. In 1991, NSA and DIA were led by 3-star military officers and NRO by a senior civilian, all 3 of whom reported to the Secretary of Defense. The CIA operated independently as the fourth major agency, with a civilian director, who was dual-hatted to lead the entire intelligence community as the director of Central Intelligence as well as serving as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He reported to the president. Each intelligence component